Before we start the clock running, is there any objection to using the blow-up? Proceed.
Good morning, members of the panel, counsel. My name is Scott Larson. I represent Shannon Mossman, who is the defendant in the trial court below. Ms. Mossman's appeal in this matter is simple and singular. Ms. Mossman appeals the court's order granting to Ms. Caldwell, one of the plaintiffs, an additional 40 acres of one of the parcels that was partitioned by the commissioner and approved by the court without a reciprocal granting of 40 acres back to her from the allocation given to Ms. Caldwell originally. Now, the plaintiffs brought this action, partition action in Jackson County, in order to force a partition by sale. The action involves two separate parcels. Parcel A is a 960-acre two pieces of ground, which constitutes a 320-acre parcel that I'll call East A, and a rectangular-shaped parcel of another 640 acres, which we'll call West A.
And East A is the headquarters site?
Yes, Your Honor. East A is the headquarters, and Ms. Mossman has lived there for decades with her family in some very modest dwellings. I think if you review the commissioner's report, there's actually no value given to the dwellings or the buildings on East A. The ownership of the two parcels is different. Parcel A is owned 50% by Mossman, 25% by Caldwell, and 25% by McNamara. Parcel B, which is the rectangle just south of West A, consists of 480 acres and is owned by 50% by Mossman and 50% by McNamara. Caldwell has no interest in that.
Let me ask another threshold question. Is parcel B in dispute here?
Well, I was just going to mention that, Your Honor. I assume from the reading of the briefs that the plaintiff's general argument that partition in kind by value is per se manifestly prejudicial to them, that they are also including parcel B. However, I would point out to the court that there is no argument in the brief. There was no evidence produced at trial or argument made at trial that the partition of parcel B was somehow manifestly prejudicial to any party. The trial court appointed Stuart Thompson as commissioner, directing him to go out, look at the property, and render a report based on his observation and his study. His report is Exhibit 1 in the record. He did that, and he rendered a report. He testified at trial that the property could be partitioned in kind based on value, reasonably, logically, and equitably between the parties. The trial court adopted that finding and those recommendations, relying in part, or actually wholly, on Young versus Wolflick, which was argued by both sides at the time. The court also find, I believe it's page 190 in the transcript, but I'm not sure what page in the record, that there is no manifest injustice to any party by partitioning this property in kind. As a threshold issue, partition by sale is disfavored in Colorado. So if a property can be partitioned in kind without manifest prejudice to any party, it should be done. Mr. Thompson was the only witness to testify with respect to partition. He was the only witness to testify with respect to value. He was called by the plaintiff. The plaintiff produced no other evidence than what Mr. Thompson produced or testified to on the stand and what appears in Exhibit 1, which is his report. The trial court specifically recognized that it was bound by Mr. Thompson's testimony and found that partition in kind by value was appropriate because it provided the only basis for the trial court's findings. Unfortunately, after the trial court did that, that brings me to our sole issue, Mossman's sole issue. The trial court creates a new interest in Ms. Caldwell's interest in the property by granting her 40 additional acres without a reciprocal swap. This all comes about, this 40-acre gift, during Mr. Milstein's examination of Mr. Thompson. Mr. Milstein was attempting to show that physical characteristics of the properties were different. And as you can see, the original allocation that Mr. Thompson suggested was that Ms. Caldwell received this portion of parcel A. It's in yellow, and I'm not sure if you can see that from your city. Mr. Milstein was concerned because it did not allow Ms. Caldwell access to her property from the BLM property, which is this U.S. section here. Mr. Thompson, in reply, said he didn't believe that was a problem, first of all, because he had already recommended easements across the Mossman land for Ms. Caldwell anyway. And then he said, it doesn't really matter, because if you take the northeast section of Mossman's allocation, this square here, and give that to Caldwell, and then take the southeast 40 acres or square, which is not designated here, but could be drawn in here, and give that to Mossman, you will affect an even swap. Partition in kind by value is preserved, no problem. The important thing is that Thompson stressed that it needed to be a swap because he partitioned his property in kind by value. And when the trial court then decided, gee whiz, we're going to give that 40 acres to Ms. Caldwell without the co-commitment swap to Mossman, we've changed the ownership interest. The trial court erred in doing that because there is no factual basis for that in the record. The factual basis for the trial court's findings and order in this case come from the testimony and the report of the commissioner. There was no other value discussion. There was no other witnesses that testified as to partition. The trial court was correct when it said it was bound by the testimony of Mr. Thompson.
Did the trial court ever explain why it chose not to do the second part of the swap and just give the 40 acres without a corresponding offset?
It just believed that it was equitable. That was the only reason. Unfortunately, that's not enough under Colorado case law. Whenever you're dealing with valuation issues, there must be evidence in the record to support that. Perfect example, Your Honors, is the Nordhausen case cited by the plaintiffs. That's the Nebraska case. The trial judge in that case simply went off on a bent and changed the ownership interest in that case, which ended up forcing partition by sale, according to the Nebraska Supreme Court. But there was no basis for his deciding that the value in that case should be something different other than his own decision. That's what happened here. The results, Your Honors, are that Caldwell received $600,000 in value of parcel A, which amounts to 29%, not 25%. Mossman received $1 million in value, which resulted in 46% of the pro rata partition, not 50%. And McNamara continued to receive $520,000 of value as recommended by Thompson, which was 25% of her interest. The trial court in this case erred by doing that, and we would ask that you reverse that particular portion of the court's order. I'll reserve the rest of my time for answer and rebuttal.
Good morning. Michael Bullock of the law firm Foster Graham Milstein and Kalischer. We represent Ms. Caldwell and Ms. McNamara, the cross-appellants in this matter, but for purposes of this oral argument, I'm going to collectively refer to them as the plaintiffs. As Mr. Larson pointed out, this appeal involves a partition of real property located in Jackson County that was jointly owned in varying degrees by both the plaintiffs and the defendants. From an organizational standpoint, I'm going to first be addressing the issues raised in the plaintiffs' cross-appeal, and then I will respond to the issues raised in the defendants' appeal as to the 40 acres. Plaintiff's position is that under Colorado law, property cannot be divided in kind if manifest prejudice to the rights of any party will result. The seminal case in Colorado is Young Properties v. Wolflick. In Wolflick, this court determined that in the context of a partition action, manifest prejudice is equivalent to great prejudice. The Wolflick case also established a two-analysis or two-factor test for determining when great prejudice would result. Great prejudice under the first factor results when the physical characteristics of the land make it impracticable to divide into equal parts. The second factor of the Wolflick test provides that great prejudice results when the value of the whole is materially greater than the sum of its parts. In this case, only the first part of the Wolflick test is at issue.
Mr. Bullock, let me ask you about prejudice in a very practical way. Your argument is that the court had no discretion to divide. The court should have done a sale, which is the – is that not your position?
That is the position, Your Honor.
Sale of the whole.
Excuse me?
A sale of the whole.
A sale of the whole because once the physical characteristics of the property established that it could not be – that it was impractical to divide into equal parts, great prejudice would result. At that point, any division of the property in kind, regardless of the methodology employed – doesn't resolve the fact that there was still great prejudice.
No, I understand, and you're going on prong one of Wolfe.
Correct.
But if you had the remedy, your preferred remedy, the whole would have been sold, and you would have had 25% each, or a total of 50% of the whole proceeds.
Correct.
You would have had basically half the value. You've gotten, do you dispute, as a matter of fact, that you basically have half the value of the overall land now? You could sell that land, couldn't you, and get half the value that you would have gotten by a sale?
I think that's a question of fact as to whether the property can be sold and the valuation of that property.
The commissioner said it could, and we're bound by that unless it's clearly erroneous, right? And you haven't challenged that finding.
We haven't challenged the valuation that was applied. However, I think we're getting to a point that the court didn't have the discretion in the first place to order a partition in kind, when the evidence showed that the physical characteristics of the property made it impractical to divide in equal parts. At that point, great prejudice is shown.
Well, that's your reading of Wolfe. I understand that. I'm just trying to drill down on you know, really where the practical prejudice is if you've got half the value, which you would have gotten after a sale.
Well, I think the practical prejudice can be shown specifically as it pertains to the 540-acre parcel that was allocated to Ms. Caldwell. Ms. Caldwell received a parcel of property that consisted only of the high mountain terrain, had no water rights, no water features, no creek frontage. It's not abutting any public road. It requires an easement, and more importantly, it requires the construction of a road at her sole cost and expense to even gain access to the property. Due to the topographic and elevation that are applied to her property, she can't even gain access to it almost 7 months out of the year.
But I'm still a little confused because ultimately she doesn't want property. She wants proceeds, according to you, the result you're seeking.
Right.
So she could just sell that, couldn't she?
Well, I think that all those factors that I just set forth, I think, hurt the marketability and sale of that particular parcel, especially when compared to the headquarters parcel, which was allocated specifically to Ms. Mossman, that has the water rights, this creek frontage. It's a beautiful place. We're talking about high mountain terrain that has limited use and requires the construction of an expensive road to even gain access to that property. So I think the marketability and sale, much like the value, is speculative.
But isn't that a fact issue on which your clients put in no evidence?
We weren't contesting the value of the property. We were contesting that the property was not able to be divided in kind in the first place.
Well, but you could have controverted marketability. I mean, that's just the other side of the coin of value.
Yes.
And you didn't.
Correct.
Thank you.
Let me just clarify, Mr. Bullock. It was my understanding, and I might be mistaken from the briefs, that the parties were not arguing about Parcel B. But if you get the relief that you're asking for, would you be asking for relief with respect to Parcel B?
Yes, Sean. We viewed the property in its totality, that although there were different ownership percentages as it pertained to different parts of the property, when viewed in its whole, the physical characteristics is what the plaintiffs were arguing, that it made it impractical to divide into equal parts.
All right. So you wanted Parcel B sold as well as Parcel A?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Was there any evidence presented that your clients utilized what you assert are the unique features of the headquarters property, the creek frontage and the like?
There was no testimony regarding the utilization of those features. However, those features benefit and enhance the property as a whole. You don't need to use a creek in order to benefit from its location on your property.
Was there any argument that your client should have been awarded that property instead of Ms. Mossman?
When you speak that property, you mean the headquarters parcel? There was an argument that said if the commissioner's division was truly fair and equitable, just swap the parcels and give the headquarters to Caldwell and McNamara and give the remaining property to Ms. Mossman. That was raised, and Ms. Mossman objected to it, which I think is evidence that the division really isn't fair and equitable. If the properties are truly fungible and can be exchanged and are of the same value, then it shouldn't matter which property Ms. Mossman received.
And what is there in the record? I didn't see a finding in the written order or the commissioner's explanation. What explanation was given for why the division was given, the headquarters was given to Ms. Mossman instead of your clients?
I believe that the commissioner testified that he was not aware, since due to the fact that the headquarters and the parcel A was owned 25-25-50, that there was, he was not aware that he could combine or that the plaintiffs were willing to take and combine their 50% interest and allocate it in that manner. And so this goes to the fact that the 320-acre parcel couldn't be practically divided based on its physical characteristics in a 25-25-50 split. Therefore, the entire 320 acres was given to Ms. Mossman, and the remainder of the property was made up in a quantity over quality analysis, or quality over quantity analysis, where greater acreage of the less popular, less valued land was given to Moss or to McNamara and Caldwell to make up for that difference.
And had Ms. Mossman lived at the headquarters site and not your clients? Is that in the record?
I don't know if that's in the record. I believe that Ms. Mossman resides there full time. I believe when Ms. Caldwell and Ms. McNamara were younger, they spent summers at the property. The determination of great prejudice or manifest prejudice is the precursor to any partition in kind. If great prejudice will not result, the property can be partitioned. Conversely, if great prejudice will result, there can logically be no in-kind partition of the property because any division is going to happen while great prejudice still exists. The evidence before the trial court, including the report and testimony of the commissioner, established that the physical characteristics of the property made it impracticable to divide into equal parts.
Whose burden of proof is manifest prejudice?
I do not know.
Thank you.
Once the evidence was established that it was impracticable to divide the property, the first part of the Wolfowitz test was met, and an in-kind partition resulted in great prejudice to the rights of plaintiffs. However, notwithstanding the establishment of this great prejudice under the Wolfowitz test, the commissioner devised and employed an alternative valuation methodology and proceeded to divide the property in kind anyway.
So let me just make sure I understand. Your position is a matter of law that if the divided properties are not roughly equivalent, what's the test, roughly equivalent in terms of kind and type of property, if the same physical characteristics, or what's the test that you would say is a matter of law that would satisfy this great prejudice prong one?
It's an impracticality test. We aren't arguing that the parcels of land after a division have to be identical to every other parcel. What we're saying is that when you view the property in its totality and take in all the physical characteristics, if it is not practical to divide that property into equal parts, then a partition in kind results in manifest prejudice.
But how do we decide practicability? I don't understand. You know, how different is too different?
Impracticality, I think, in general, is impossible to be carried out effectively. In this case, again, I'll point to Ms. Caldwell's parcel, that she received a parcel of land that was substantially different than what she owned beforehand. Before the partition, she owned a 25% share of the headquarters and 25% share of the rest of parcel A. After the division, all she received was a parcel of land that consisted of high mountain terrain with none of the benefits, none of the creek frontage, none of the direct access to the BLM land, absent the court's allocation of that additional 40 acres. The court specifically, when it provided that extra 40 acres, said it recognized it was penalizing the Mossman property, but in light of their acquisition of the entire headquarters parcel, it was fair and equitable. I think that statement in and of itself is an implied indication from the court that it recognized that all the good property went to one party and that Ms. Caldwell was being left, especially, with what remained.
That leads you to your defense, I guess, your alternative defense of the extra 40 acres is what, that the property wasn't as valuable, so it's just kind of a rough offset, or it ultimately changed the valuation, didn't it? The extra 40 acres without an offset gave your clients, or one of your clients, more value than a 25% division would have given.
If you from a purely mathematical standpoint, I believe that's correct. However, the court did not allocate an additional 40 acres to Ms. Caldwell under a monetary analysis or to provide her with greater value. It was done as an equitable remedy to provide her with a more direct access and means to get to her otherwise landlocked parcel. And that's not to say that she could even get to the parcel right now due to the snow, the elevation, the topographic elements. Mr. Mossman, who resides up there full-time, clearly said that the property is generally inaccessible from October till May of each year.
What evidence is there in the record that supports the trial court's determination to give the extra 40 acres to one of your clients?
I think the evidence in the record was the testimony of Mr. Thompson that she did not have, as he originally laid it out, land abutting the BLM to provide her with direct access to her parcel.
Okay. What evidence in the record permitted the trial court to do that, to give that allocation to your client without giving the offsetting 40 acres to Ms. Mossman?
I don't know if there was evidence in the record. The court did so under its discretion to craft a fair and equitable remedy. And it determined, based on all of the evidence in the record, that the allocation of the property to Ms. Caldwell was not a fair and equitable result. Therefore, it granted an additional 40 acres, not based because of monetary valuation or providing her with extra compensation. It was done solely to provide her with a more direct means of accessing her property.
But the court could have done that by and also given an offset. I mean, if the issue is access, the court's given access by giving the, I guess it's the northern part of the property, and could take away the southern, couldn't it?
Yeah, the court could have done that, but it specifically found that by granting that additional 40 acres, it was not causing any injustice. And again, it said that in light of the allocation of the headquarters parcel entirely to Ms. Mossman, it found it to be a fair and equitable result. That is an admission, implied at least from the court, that Ms. Mossman received the valuable portion of the property and that Ms. Caldwell was left with whatever remained.
Doesn't the fact that Mossman resided on the property and Caldwell didn't strongly favor in-kind partition as opposed to sale, which would, you know, dispossess Ms. Mossman of her home?
I believe the case law that I reviewed indicated that the homestead only applied if there were children present that lived on the property, and that was not the case here. Additionally, Stuart Thompson attributed zero value to the improvements that are on the property, so Ms. Mossman's contention that she lived there and she should be provided some extra benefit or consideration because it was her home was not considered by the court, nor is it persuasive.
Well, is it disputed that she lived there, and in the event of sale versus partition in kind, she'd have to go live someplace else?
No, I don't think that's disputed. It's if the property sold, she can't live there unless she obtains a lease from whoever buys the property.
Thank you.
The evidence in this case, you know, that was presented at trial, both the testimony and the commissioner's report indicated that the physical characteristics of the property made it impractical to divide into equal parts, thus satisfying the first factor of the Wolfolk test and establishing greater manifest prejudice. The trial court's subsequent partition of the property in kind based on this alternative valuation methodology ignored the Wolfolk test and resulted in manifest prejudice to the rights of the plaintiffs. Thank you.
This case is Wolfolk. It's the same situation. Wolfolk, this court has specifically approved partition in kind by valuation. That's what happened in Wolfolk. You need only look at the numbers there to determine that. Plaintiff's argument boils down to, if you can't cut the property up acre by acre equally, then it's automatically manifest prejudice. That's not the law in this state. It's not the law in any state, period. And it's not what the statute says. The trial court here did exactly what it was supposed to do with respect to partition. The commissioner did exactly what he was supposed to do. Partition in kind does not necessarily mean acre per acre. That's not the rule. The commissioner here took into consideration all of the different characteristics of the property. That's why he came up with different values for different sections. Your Honor makes a wonderful point. The result here is no different than if there would have been a partition by sale to the plaintiffs. They get 100% of the value that they wanted in the first place by the commissioner's allocation. No question asked. That's not disputed. Mr. Bullock tells you they don't dispute the valuation. So why there's this argument over, though, that the 320 acres was more valuable, I don't know, because the commissioner took that into consideration. He, by acres, penalized Ms. Mossman because of that. That's not a problem.
Does his report address the question of marketability?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And the tract that they got is marketable as the whole?
I'm sorry, the 320?
The larger tract is as marketable as if the ranch had been sold as a whole?
Absolutely.
And that's in his report?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
There's no problem with that.
Where in the report, counsel, if you know?
And I'm sorry, Your Honor, I did not have that committed to memory. I believe it's somewhere near page 24 is my recollection, is where he says that the property in this method, in this manner, can be equitably, logically, and reasonably partitioned.
And you would concede that if it was less marketable in part than it was as a whole, that would be manifest prejudice?
I believe that that's what Wolflick says, Your Honor. I agree with that. But there is no evidence in the record that that's the case, and the commissioner clearly did not find that. And therefore, it's kind of moot. There is a terrible lack of evidence on the plaintiff's part with respect to their burden to prove manifest prejudice. Their argument really is nothing more than, gee, it's per se manifestly prejudicial to our clients if you don't give them an acre per acre slice of every parcel. If you look at parcel B, which is owned, and I will tell the court that as part of one of my affirmative defenses in this case was that this was not a single partition action. It should have been a double partition action. Parcel B is all High Mountain property. And High Mountain is somewhat of a misnomer. The highway runs at the bottom of this diagram. The only place where there's actual possible legal access to any of these parcels, any of them, is down here where the highway crosses and at the McNamara allocation. The headquarters property does not have legal access to the road. There's a strip of land here that prevents that. That strip of land is owned by Ms. Moss. She purchased that separate, but there is no legal access to this property. And that appears, I believe, on one of the beginning pages of Mr. Thompson's report. So this access argument that they make is a little bit superfluous because the access to all of this property is suspect. And everybody knew that going in. The BLM land, you're not automatically granted access to landlocked property through BLM land. So the access issue is kind of a red herring here. And that's why when the court gave Caldwell the extra 40 acres, there was no basis of fact, none. And I think through questioning, counsel can't really point you to that. All he can say, all the counsel can tell you is that the court's finding was, gee, I find this more equitable. In the next breath, he said, this penalizes Ms. Mossman, but gee, she got the headquarters. Well, she lives in the headquarters, and that's fine. But Mr. Thompson considered the fact that she got the headquarters, and he considered in his partition in kind by value the increased value of the lower land versus the upper land, and then he adjusted the acreage accordingly. And I think if you look at maybe the answer brief of the plaintiffs, you will see a nice table, and it shows that by acreage, the plaintiffs received more across the board acreage percentage-wise than what was their allocable interest 25-25 in parcel A. But that's fine because the value is different. Mr. Thompson concedes that, yeah, you can't take into consideration, you take it into consideration, but in the end it doesn't affect value. All these little minor things, these little snippets in the record that the plaintiff calls to your attention to show that this was, quote, impractical to partition in kind. And that's the real test. What is impractical? Young versus Wolflick will tell you that impracticability does not include simple differences in what's on the land. Remember in Wolf Lick, one party got a residence there. The other party got unimproved land. And this court approved that division in kind based on value. The party that got the land that did not have the residence received a greater share of acreage, than they should have. My time is 10 seconds, and I really have no other issues unless the court has something they want to ask me. Thank you for your consideration.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. A written opinion will issue in due course. And since that exhausts our morning docket, the bailiff may announce a recess.
All rise. The court will be in recess, subject to